So, today we are starting the chapter 10 called Vibhuti Yoga or Divine Glories. Divine Glories. Now, even though the Bhagavad Gita has been divided into different chapters from 1 to 18, and when I first started studying it, I used to think that they are just chapters thrown haphazardly, and I really did not see the sequence. And then the more you listen to a teacher like Swami Chinmayananda, you realize that there is a very beautiful thread, continuous thread that runs through the entire Bhagavad Gita. And so there is a very beautiful thread that is running through the entire Gita, and there is a very, very nice sequence of teachings. So they are very, very wonderfully connected, and you can follow how the thought evolution is happening. Just to briefly summarize, we have done that before, but just very briefly revise what is the sequence of thought in the Bhagavad Gita. The first chapter is called Arjuna Vishad Yoga, where Arjuna, the student, is confused and does not know what is his duty and does not know why he is where he is. Why is he fighting the war, not realizing that it is a conflict between good and evil, where the evil, if it is not eradicated, like a cancer, will take over the society. Just as a cancer has to be wiped out, and if you leave it alone and say, oh, I'm going to be very peaceful and loving, then that cancer will destroy your whole body. So the Kauravas were like a cancer which had taken over the body of India at that time and had to be removed, and that was the reason this conflict or this war occurred. And Arjuna was confused, you know, what is my duty? These are my cousins, and I, on the other side, I see my grandfather and my uncle and all my near and dear ones, and war creates so many problems, and all those pacifist, you know, ideas, which were very legitimate ideas, but in that situation, they did not apply because Kauravas were a very poisonous element. And so the teacher, Krishna, then from the second chapter onwards, starts teaching him why he should do his duty, because he's a warrior, he's the leader of the Pandava, of the good forces. And if he surrenders and runs away from the battle, you know, the evil will triumph. And so he tells him his duties from at all levels, you know, how, why he should perform his duty. Then he tells him about death, that death is not the end. The soul is immortal and the body dies. And then, you know, how the theory of reincarnation, he teaches him all that. It's too long to go into detail, but I would encourage everybody, if you don't have this series of Bhagavad Gita texts, please buy them, because they have all the 18 chapters from 1 to 18. And Swamiji, Swami Chinmayananda, has done a very beautiful commentary. So I think everybody should have that, because this is the text we follow. And for 18 chapters, I think the price is only $27. It's not much, but it gives you really a wealth of information. So you can, on your own leisure, and people say, oh, it's too much, you know, to read. But the way I look at it is the Bhagavad Gita is 700 verses. You say, oh, 700 verses? It's a lot. But Swami Chinmayananda at one time had given a reading assignment. He said, just read 2 verses every day. 2 verses is not hard. You know, when you say 700, you get overwhelmed. But just read 2 verses, and the commentary may be about 5 pages. So you can read 2 verses every day. Yes, I can read 2 verses. Just read 2 verses every night before you go to sleep. And within a year, 350 days, you would have done the entire Bhagavad Gita. And so 1 year, you have studied this masterful text. And also by reading 2 verses a day, you can go into the depth of the knowledge and then contemplate upon it during the day, what I have read at night. And if you just do that, in 1 year, you would have become a master of this beautiful text. So anyway, so in the second chapter, he tells him about his duty, about reincarnation, and that death is not the end of the journey, you know, the soul continues. And then towards the end of the second chapter, he gives him an ideal. The student asks, what is the goal, or what is, how does the wise person conduct himself or herself in the world? And so the teacher gives him the sthita prajna lakshyani, which means the characteristics of a wise person, how a wise person should function. So giving him an ideal to shoot for. And then in the third chapter, he continues this topic of karma yoga, how one should do one's duty dedicated to the Lord without ego, without unselfishness, and how that can benefit you and also benefit society. Then in the fourth chapter, the teaching continues where he talks about, now I should not only work as an individual entity, but I should be willing to work with all. So all people work together for the benefit of all, for the benefit of society. So what is called as the yajna principle, where you sacrifice your individual ego for the good of all. And the whole community works as one, or the whole church, or the whole organization. In the fifth chapter, then he tells him about karma sannyas yoga, where even the sense of doership should go away. You know, when I do something very good, I served so many people, I fed the homeless, I built this temple or church, and I donated so much money, I did such a wonderful job. And then I have to have my plaque there, and they put it, and then people come and praise me, and then my little ego develops, you know, that, oh, I am such a great person. So he says, even that little sense of doership, that even when you have done good, you should immediately dedicate it to the Lord. Lord, it is you who gave me everything. Whatever I am is because of you. Whatever I have is your gift to me. And if I gave it, it is nothing. It is you who is functioning through me. So that even the sense that I am doing something, because actually I am not. What am I without him? Without this Lord, the consciousness within us, what are we? Swami Chinmayananda, Gurudev says, you are a bunch, you're just a pile of manure. If the consciousness is not there, all we are good for is fertilizing the plants. We have absolutely no abilities, nothing. So everything is happening because of his presence, but one just has to remember that. And remind yourself, anytime somebody praises you, immediately dedicate Krishnarpanamastu. Lord, I dedicate it to you. Then immediately your ego doesn't rise, and that is what is taught in the fifth chapter. Now, having prepared the student through service, through dedication, through love for the Lord, and through giving up the ego, he says, now you are ready for meditation. See, you and I, we sit down, oh, you know, that is good. You sit and try to meditate, but you have to prepare your mind. So why am I meditating? And what is the goal? That can only be clear when my mind has been purified with service, with dedication, with love for the Lord. So it does not mean that if you are meditating, you stop meditating, or if you are doing yoga, you stop. But remember that your meditation, or even the puja, even the prayer when you do, you offer prayers to the Lord, everything will be more effective if you accompany that by service and by dedication and by reduction of ego. So then in the sixth chapter, the teacher tells the student how to meditate. And that's what we are studying on Thursday evening. Some of you come on Thursday evening at 6:30, and we are studying the yoga of meditation and all the techniques. And then the seventh to the ninth is the highest knowledge. The seventh, eighth, and ninth chapters give the highest knowledge of the Upanishads, because the Upanishads were taught to students who were already very evolved. They had already given up, you know, the world. They had studied a lot. They were very, very evolved students. And so the Upanishads are taught in a very difficult Sanskrit. Even to understand as Sanskrit is very difficult. The Bhagavad Gita is comparatively easier. And the ideas are given in such a indicative fashion. It's not directly told. So you have to have a very evolved student and an evolved teacher to understand. And that's why Swami Chinmayananda has done wonderful commentaries on the Upanishads to make them easy to understand for us in English. But that same knowledge has been even simplified further in the 7th, 8th, and 9th chapter, where this idea that there is only one God, there is only one consciousness, one Brahman, which is formless, all-pervading, and all forms are in him. Everything emerges from him, whether you call it Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or Shiva or Mother Durga, or doesn't matter what, but all forms arise from that one consciousness. This whole universe is nothing but a shadow, just like a image, projection upon that consciousness. Even though we see differences, you know, she's my friend and he's my enemy and I love this person and I hate this person. But a wise person sees the one divinity in all. Just as potter who knows mud, he may see different parts. You know, we may see, oh, this is a teapot and this is a kettle and this is a vase and this is a red vase and a blue vase and this is a Chinese vase and this is a Japanese. But A person who knows mud understands these are all mud and nothing but mud and mud alone, clay. So a wise person sees that one divinity, and that is the essence of that, that this world is nothing but a projection upon that consciousness. The consciousness alone is appearing as this whole world. And you and I, in our foolishness, we distinguish this is my house and that is her house and this is my property, and how I can take over the neighbor's property, how I can take over the neighbor's factory, and how can I take over the neighbor's country. That is all comes out of the wrong understanding that everything is that one consciousness. And especially in the 9th chapter, which we have just finished, I'd like to spend a little bit of time summarizing, because the 9th chapter, in my opinion, has the highest knowledge. And I would urge everybody to read the 9th chapter again, because it is so beautifully given. In the 9th chapter, the main essence of the 9th chapter is that there is one consciousness, and this whole world has emerged from that. And then the student asks, how am I to approach, and why should I even bother to know? You know, my life is going fine. I go to work, I earn, I come home, I take care of my family. Everything is going fine. They say, no, one who knows me will get supreme joy. The Lord said, and one who does not and just keeps on acquiring, possessing, holding, then will keep on suffering in the world. The way to get out of the suffering is to realize that immortal truth, which is your own nature. You are not far from me. And that message is given very clearly in the 9th chapter. Not only the message of why one should realize the truth, but how. The techniques are very beautifully explained. And he says, yat karoshi yad ashnasi yad juhoshi dadasi yat yat tapasyasi kaunteya tat kurushva madarpanam. O Kaunteya, Arjuna, whatever you do, whatever you sacrifice, whatever prayers you offer, whatever job you are doing, even whether you are cleaning the floor or whether you are doing the dishes or whether you are seeing patients, dedicate everything to me, and that you are doing it for me. When I'm cleaning the house, you say the Lord resides in this house. That's why I want to keep this house clean. When I'm cleaning my body, I do that because the Lord resides here. Does not mean that I have to spend hours beautifying it, but you know, I have to keep my body clean and healthy because the Lord resides. And similarly, the Lord resides in every other body. So that idea, one, when you understand, then you, every action can become a prayer. Then you don't really need to sit down and pray. I mean, you can sit down and pray. That's very good. And you should have some dedicated time. But if you're doing every activity as a prayer, then, you know, you are already there. Then you are already a Mahatma. You are already a realized saint. And there are some very beautiful verses where the teacher says, Krishna says, that one who dedicates all their activities to me, works for me, then I take care of them. Ananyas chinta yanto mam ye jana paryupasate tesham nitya bhiyukta nam yoga kshemam vahamyaham. I take care of those people. You don't have to worry who's going to take care of me, who's going to take care of my wife and children. You do my work, I'll do your work. Even in the Quran, it says very beautifully. It says, one who takes care of other people, Allah takes care of them. The same ideas are there in all the scriptures. So that is what the essence of the 9th chapter is. And now, having heard this, the student is very thrilled, you know, because, wow, so there is this highest knowledge, yeah, and I can know that, yes, and it is possible for me to know it. Yes, it is possible for you to know it, just as Jesus knew it, Buddha knew it, Shankaracharya knew it, Swami Chinmayananda knew it. You can also know it. So then he starts thinking, you know, but you tell me that that's how the 10th chapter starts. There is a doubt in Arjuna's mind. He says, you say you are everywhere. Krishna is representing the all-pervading consciousness. He says, you are everywhere. Yes. Well, then why don't I see you? Are you in this chair? Yes, I am in this chair. Are you in this man? Yes, I am. Are you in this woman? Yes, I am. Are you in the plant, bird, animal, fish, rock, stones? Yes, I am everywhere. He said, then why don't I see you? If you are everywhere, I should see God. You know, I should be able to touch him and hold him and speak to him and talk to him. Somebody asked Raman Maharishi one time, you know, can you show me God? Raman Maharishi was a great saint in India in the 20th century. So Raman Maharishi says, I can show you God. He says, okay, show me. So he moved his finger. So he said, what? I just see your finger moving. He says, yeah, this is God. Because if God was not in me, this finger would be a piece of flesh, would be dead. I would have to be taken to the cemetery. The fact that I am moving this finger, that is immediately an expression of God. So, but Arjuna said, no, I don't understand it like that. Tell me your postal address. How can I write you a letter? Or how can I find you? And, you know, you are not, it's not very clear. I don't understand. You say you are that all-pervading, formless consciousness called Brahman. I don't know who is Brahman. I have not seen Brahman. That's why even the gopis, you know, when Krishna, you know the story of gopis and Krishna, when Krishna had left, and the gopis, these were these village girls, and they were missing him. So Krishna sent one of his friends, Uddhav, to teach the gopis a lesson. And Uddhav was very proud about his knowledge that I am the Brahman, you know, I have so much knowledge of Vedanta, I can teach them about Brahman. And so they go and tell, he goes and tells them, you don't need to worship Krishna, he's just a form. You should worship the Brahman, that is all pervading consciousness, Nirgun, and all that, you know. And he was trying to give them the highest knowledge. And the gopis were simple and they loved God. They loved Krishna. So they said, look, Uddhav, don't tell us all this. Tell him, where does your Nirgun live? Can we see him? Can we touch him? No, Krishna was with us. We held him, we touched him, we embraced him. We saw him playing in the forest. We heard him playing his flute. So that is the kind of God we want to love. We don't care about this formless. You can keep this knowledge to yourself. So, well, idea is that, you know, there are different schools of philosophy. It does not mean one is superior or another one is inferior. But for some people, they want to love God in a form. I love God as Krishna. It makes me happier. When I see Jesus, it reminds me of his love and compassion. Or when I see the Mother Goddess, I'm filled with love for her. And another person says, I don't see God. I see God in all the people, like Mahatma Gandhi. He says, I see them in all the Harijans, among the people who have been persecuted and the poor people. I see the Lord in that. And serving them, I serve the Lord. Another person sits in meditation and Brahman, and he says, Aham Brahmasmi, me and this whole universe is that one consciousness. So there are different ways of looking at this consciousness. But Arjuna in this chapter wants to know, where is God? How can I find him? How can I easily see him? Are there any signs or symbols of how I can see God? I was reading a very beautiful example. They say that, say, now there is a hunter and he is looking for an elephant, for a particular rare kind of elephant that, you know, he wants to capture or he wants to, you know, reach. So what does he do? Now somebody tells him, you know, this particular elephant you were looking for went this way through the forest. So he'll start going through the forest, and there he starts tracking. Like one place he sees the leaves have been crushed, and he says, this is not a lion track or a tiger, it is the tracks of an elephant. It is big. So he knows that elephant passed through here, and then he sees a tree where the elephant rubbed his body. And there are some little marks, and then he goes a little further, and then he can smell, and then he can see where the leaves have been broken because the elephant ate the leaf. So seeing these signs and symbols, he's able to track the elephant. So these signs and symbols are not the elephant, but a wise person can track them and reach the goal. There's another very beautiful story. The Buddha, you know, when he was living on the earth, he used to go from village to preach. And slowly, slowly, he accumulated a following. And there were 20, 30, 50, you know, monks who used to go with him. And they would go to one village and Buddha would preach. And then he would go to another village and so on. And he, through his lifetime, he traveled through maybe a few hundred miles. So there was a spiritual student who wanted to find Buddha. He had heard that there is this great saint, this great prophet who has appeared on earth. And he said, I have to meet him. I have to find him. Now, he didn't know where he was. In those days, they didn't have email and they didn't have iPhone S or whatever, 4S. They didn't have all those things, you know, internet and newspaper and TV. You know, nowadays the reporter follows, you know, the Buddha is traveling and they have live, you know, broadcasts. Nothing of that sort. You know, he just had by word of mouth. And he wanted to find Buddha. So he said, let me go out. So he starts going. And somebody says, you know, he was last in this village. And he goes to that village and he finds that people there are so calm and so peaceful and so loving. And he said, the great Buddha must have passed. Because this is a symbol. If the people have been changed, then some great person must have gone through. And so he goes to the second village. And then at one place he comes to a fork in the road. And he goes one way. And he finds that the people are still very rude and very arrogant and very... He says, no, Buddha couldn't have come in this way. He retraces his step and goes to the other village and he says, yes, this is where the Buddha has walked through because the people have been changed. Everybody is so peaceful, so calm and so loving and everybody's talking about the highest knowledge. And so that's how slowly, 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 village after village, he finally reaches the Buddha and falls at his feet and says, please take me also as your student, as I want to be with you. But I see how just by walking through a village, you have changed the people. How wonderful it would be for me if I could live with you and become one of your followers. So the idea is that to see the Lord, you don't, you know, at the highest, of course, if you become a great saint like Raman Maharishi or Swami Vivekananda or Mirabai or Tukaram, yeah, in that, or Mother Teresa or Saint Francis, you may in your meditation, in your prayer, see him. But for most of us who are not that evolved, who have not reached that state, how can we see the Lord constantly, everywhere, at all times? Because he is everywhere. He is there at all times. How can I see him? That is explained very beautifully in this 10th chapter, that where and how you can find him. So here, just one more line about introduction. And then we shall start the chapter. There are two concepts explained in this chapter. It's called the Vibhuti Yoga. The Vibhuti means the glories. Yoga means the science. But also the word Vibhuti and Yoga has been interpreted in two different ways in the 10th chapter, where the Vibhuti is also called the Samashti. Samashti means the macrocosm, the total. And yoga means the vyashti, or the microcosm, or the individual. So what do we mean by macrocosm and microcosm, samashti or vyashti? So coming back to this chart, I think most of you are familiar with this chart. But I am the body, mind and intellect. Body, I perceive the objects. With the mind, I feel all the emotions, good and bad. And with the intellect, I think the thoughts. So I am this individuality called BMI, and that is how we understand ourselves to be. And then we are the vasanas. These are my habits or my tendencies, which can be good or bad. I can have good habits or bad habits, good tendencies or bad tendencies, and that's what makes me do good or bad. That's what makes a saint a saint. That's what makes a sinner a sinner. That's what makes an alcoholic. That's what makes a sportsman, a businessman is whatever my tendencies. So, Om represents God's presence or consciousness. So this consciousness, when it works through one individual or identifies with one individual, me or you, with the individual's vasanas, you know, what happens is that why did we take birth? Because of our vasanas, our tendencies, because we had unfulfilled tendencies and unfulfilled desires, and that's why we took birth again. And each and every birth that we are taking is because we have these desires, we have these vasanas, we have these selfish tendencies. And the goal of spiritual progress is to slowly, slowly reduce these vasanas, these desires, make your actions unselfish, make them pure, make them dedicated to the Lord. And as you do that, your vasanas get reduced. And then you become a saint, because a saint has no selfish desires. His or her whole desire is to know the Lord and to serve the Lord and be a servant, be the Lord's instrument. And such a person then does not need to be born again. But you and I took birth because we had these vasanas. So this consciousness functioning through an individual vasana becomes the individual. So there is only one consciousness, which we call as, you can call it Om, you can call it Brahman, you can call it Father in Heaven, Allah. It doesn't matter what you call it, but there is only one consciousness. When it functions through an individual, it becomes an individual. It can be Anil or Hansa or Arun or Kerry, whatever name you want to give it. But each one of us is an expression of that one consciousness, and that is the Vyashti, the microcosm or the individual expression. Now, this same consciousness is also there in the whole world, right? We said it is there in all the plants and all the rocks and all the birds and fish and humans and everywhere. So this same consciousness, when it functions through the total vasanas, the total creative force, which they call as Maya. In our Sanskrit, they give the name Maya. Maya is nothing but the total creative power of the Lord. The individual power creates the individual world, but the totality creates the total consciousness. And that is what is called as the Samashti, also called as the Bhubuti, also called as the macrocosm. So the total universe, all the entire universe, all the planets and stars and moon and humans and planets, not only this, but even the higher worlds and the lower worlds, you know, the worlds of the heavens and the gods and the worlds of the demons and the ghosts. And so the Chodelok, you know, the 14 worlds are all an expression of that one consciousness functioning through Maya, which they call as the totality. And so that same consciousness is functioning through all, the same consciousness is functioning through me. And that is the essence of this 10th chapter, that tell me, the student says, tell me who you are among all and tell me who you are in the individual. I want to see you like that. I do not understand these concepts of consciousness and Brahman and all-pervading and formless. No, I don't want all that. I want to see you in the form, in the flesh. So that is the essence of this very, very beautiful chapter, where it is like you have studied, you know, the Pythagoras theorem, the square on the hypotenuse is the sum of the square on the other two sides. Okay, I studied that. And so this in the fifth grade or the sixth grade, the student learns. But then the teacher will give him 20 or 30 or 40 examples. Okay, these are all the tests. Go home and do them and bring them back. And in every one of them, he has to apply the Pythagoras theorem. And there are, some are triangles and some she's showing him a building and some there are all different. So why? So that by doing those 20 or 30 or 40 problems, when the student comes back next morning, she is very sure that she has understood the Pythagoras theorem. And the teacher also knows that this child has understood. Why? Because she was able to do all the 30 problems using that one theorem that I taught her yesterday. So this is that kind of exercises in contemplation, where that one idea can be clearly explained to everybody, and that is the idea of this wonderful chapter.